I'll read Daniel chapter 1 and verses 1 and 2. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Over the next 4 months, we are going to be going through the prophecy of Daniel. Now, that isn't just an opening line to a new series. We are going to be going through the prophecy of Daniel. That is a promise that I've just made that I can't wriggle out of. If I'd have said we are going to do some studies in the book of Daniel, then I know what would have happened. We'd have done chapters 1 to 6, and we'd have got to the end of chapter 6, and I'd have said, now that was really interesting, wasn't it? Let's go and do something else. We would have gone through those familiar chapters of the lion's den and the fiery furnace and the disembodied hand or fingers writing on the wall, but we probably wouldn't have got any further. But having said we are going to go through Daniel, we are also going to take on chapters 7 to 12 with their strange visions and their, at times, terrifying pictures that Daniel is given as he goes from a sort of narrative in the first 6 chapters to a form of writing that we call apocalyptic in the second part of the book. So we're going to do it that way because that's what God's given to us. Too many series are just about Daniel 1 to 6. We're going to do not that Daniel light, we're going to do Daniel full fat, which is what God has given us here. And it's a fabulous book, which I think for too long has been seen as good material for the Sunday school or for the children's clubs. Well, good for the Sunday school and the children's clubs for taking Daniel on. But let's not think that we haven't got as much, if not more, to learn from this book as they have. It's a book that will stretch us and challenge us. It will alarm us as well as encourage us. But most of all, it ought to build faith as we see one of our ancestors in the faith plunged into the chaotic upheavals of the 6th century BC, into a world that was alien to anything he had known before, and not just surviving in that world, but thriving. And he and his friends that we met in chapter 1, they did that not because they were somehow cut from a different part of humanity than we are. They weren't. They were people like us. But they were able to do this because they knew their God. And they loved their God. And they trusted their God. And they listened to him. And they prayed to him. And one thing that Daniel is going to hit us with week by week is that the God of Daniel was an awesome God. He did impossible things. And Daniel will then be prodding us and he'll be saying, but the God of Daniel, you can't talk about in the past tense. He's the God of today. And the God of Daniel is your God, and he hasn't changed. And the promises that he made in this great book, they haven't changed. All that's happened is we're further down history in seeing them being realized. It's not that the God of Daniel has retreated. He's advanced towards us, and we've seen more of him. Well, this morning, we're just going to do a short introduction to the book, and then your homework is to go away, read these wonderful 12 chapters, and then read them again and again and again, and make my life easy, because you'll know it all already. So, first of all, as we do an introduction, let's think about Daniel's times. We've got dates and names and events sketched into the opening two verses of the book, the third year of the reign of King Jehoiakim. Now, we would call that 605 BC. He wouldn't. He didn't know about BC and AD. He would have called it the third year of his reign, and it was a rather alarming year in Jehoiakim's reign. But 605 BC to us, as we look at history, is the year in which the ancient world changed. It was a momentous year. A new superpower had arisen and had become stronger and stronger till eventually it was able to take on and defeat the existing superpower. The existing superpower was Egypt. The new kid on the block was Babylon. And Babylon, under the leadership of its crown prince, who would become king later that year, Nebuchadnezzar, met the Egyptian armies in a great battle that historians still talk about today, the Battle of Carchemish in 605 BC. And Assyria routed, Babylon routed the Egyptians in that battle. Now, unfortunately for Judea, this was not like a heavyweight contest of the world in which these two superpowers slugged it out and then went away to just get on with life. Babylon, having conquered Egypt, now wanted to dominate the whole world. And it wanted to subjugate every area of its empire. And so in that same year, Nebuchadnezzar brought his mighty armies to little Jerusalem. And the outcome was inevitable. Jerusalem was the capital city of the tiny remnant of Israel, Judea. The 10 northern tribes had been swallowed up by another superpower, Assyria, 100 years earlier. And the two tribes of Judea, or Judah and Benjamin, were left with Jerusalem, the capital. And unsurprisingly, when Nebuchadnezzar pitched up with his stormtroopers, Jerusalem fell. Nebuchadnezzar transported the cream of the population off to Babylon to serve in his civil service. He took Daniel away, and Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah. Looked around the universities, found the best people, found the ones who had the greatest promise, shipped them all off to Babylon. And he did something else. He took some loot with him, verse 2 says. Probably walked into the temple with a couple of his generals and the curator of the Babylonian Museum and just to gather that stuff up and put it in the archives. Just how easy it seemed to Nebuchadnezzar. How unremarkable it must have seemed to this general. Just another conquest. Doesn't make much of it in the history books. The big battle was Carchemish, defeating Egypt. This was like Macclesfield Town at home after you just defeated Liverpool. You know, this was simple. And you can imagine him saying to those curators of the museum, you know, this is exhibit 1,310,537. Pop it in the archives. There's a little tag saying golden cup from some building in Jerusalem. You ever wondered why Daniel mentions these vessels of the temple in verse 2? Amongst all of the traumas of leaving home and seeing the city being destroyed eventually and the loss of life and the siege of the city, why does he mention the pots and pans and cups and plates from the temple? Maybe they meant a lot to Daniel and the boys growing up. Maybe they could visit them in the museum in the house of his foreign gods. Go and look at things that reminded them of home. Or maybe it's because they're going to reappear in the story in chapter 5. And maybe men who mock God and thought that they could consign him to the museum of history are going to be made to think again. That's going to be a theme of Daniel. Don't you dare think you can put God in a museum. He'll make you think again. But Daniel, from his own perspective, must have thought these were the darkest days imaginable, because everything has fallen apart. For him and his friends, the fall of Jerusalem was not the inevitable outcome of when the greatest military power on earth takes on a little place with about as much strength as, say, the Isle of Wight. To them, the outcome was not inevitable, because previously, when Jerusalem had met the Assyrian superpower, it was Assyria that fell, because God was protecting his people. But this time, God had not protected his people. And that raised big theological questions for Daniel. Did it mean that God had become weak? Did it mean that the gods of the Babylonians were mightier than the God of Israel? Had God finished with his people? Had he retreated from the scene? Was this the post-Yahweh age that we were now to be living in? What did it mean for all the promises that God had given to Israel? To David, that one of his sons was going to reign forever and ever? What did it mean for the promises that God had made to the world? That there would one day be a new age and salvation and a resurrection? Had God been defeated? Had all of these promises come crashing down? What would Daniel and his friends do? Would they stay true to a God who seemed to have been defeated? Or would they conform and forget their past and just accept being Babylonian? Well, the response shows that they held on by faith even in the darkest days. And I love that with Daniel. It's not what Daniel sees that determines what he does. It's what he believes. And it might look as though God has been defeated, but Daniel's God can't be defeated. There must be another answer. And we'll come to that in a moment. But these were difficult days in which to live as the people of God. They were dangerous days. They have to live in Babylon. This is the first time since they've taken over their own land that they have been outside of their land, living in an alien culture. Now, you and I know about that. We do it every day of our lives. And it's like a forerunner, I think, in the Old Testament for what we as the church would go through. But this was the first time for them that they'd done this. And they live in a world where the state is trying to influence everything, your identity. It decides to eradicate your history. Your past doesn't matter. We will give you a new name and a new identity. It determines what people are taught, how you spoke, what you ate, how you worshipped. It's a world that wants people to conform to its values and its ideas. And if you don't, if you step out of line, if you're a nonconformist, then in this world you are going to suffer. Because we'll see that there are lions' dens for dissidents to be thrown into. And there's a fiery furnace with a 7 times hotter setting for when the king is particularly angry. But it's also a world in which the kings are not as powerful as they think they are. There are always these shadowy powers behind the scenes that can manipulate the kings. And that reminds me of our world. We'll see more of these in the latter chapters of Daniel. We see more in the New Testament. There are forces of darkness and wickedness. This isn't a benign world in which we live. And I think this was the world that Daniel was led into, and we'll find that there is some similarities with our days. And yet in these times, he not only survives for 70 years, but he glorifies God and gets to know God and bears witness to God through the reign of four kings in a life of radical faith and obedience. So, secondly, let's look at Daniel's God. And this really will be the important part of this series. What we need to do is to behold our God and to get to know him better. The book of Daniel will be amazing and thrilling as it shows us, in spite of all that we see, whatever we think is going on in 2019, God is still on the throne and he reigns over everything. When we get to chapter 7, and all the sensible churches will have bailed out at the end of chapter 6, they're not the sensible ones. Chapter 7 is absolutely amazing. Daniel will see this vision of beasts coming up out of the sea. He'll see the winds of heaven stirring up the great sea. The sea is our world. And out of it come these four beasts, one after another. It's a succession of kingdoms. First Babylonia, then Medo-Persia, then Greece, and then Rome. And the last kingdom troubles Daniel because it seems so hideous, and it begins to mutate before his very eyes. Things begin to grow out of it. The commentators think it's a succession of powers that follow on from the Roman Empire, even going through our times. But there's one sinister, especially anti-Christ type of power that is doing so much damage to everything. And Daniel looks at it and he's terrified, and then he's made to look up. And he gets to see into heaven. And he sees thrones. And he sees God's throne. He sees God himself as the Ancient of Days, older than the universe, bigger than our little time. I'm going to read it to you. I can't wait to get onto it. Chapter 7, verse 9. As I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames. Its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. 1,000 thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. How I need to see that in 2019. Amidst all of the upheavals of the world in which we live, amongst all the noise and all the raging, just look up, says Daniel. See what I saw. See God's throne. God as the God of fire and the God of power. And all these other kingdoms are beneath him and they're subject to him. And at his word, they rise and they fall. This is one of the great themes of Daniel. God is on the throne. And that's true in the darkest days, as well as in the most blessed days. He reigns. Well, there's that hymn of praise that we'll get to in chapter 2, verse 20, where Daniel is given Nebuchadnezzar's dream. Impossible. And yet, God does that. And Daniel says, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, to whom belongs wisdom and might. He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He's the God who changes the times and the seasons. He's the God who turns the pages of history. He turned the page on Jehoiakim, chapter 1, verse 2. Judah's exile and Jehoiakim's fall was not the consequence of Yahweh's failure. It was the consequence of Jehoiakim's failure. And the Lord had simply given him up and turned the page on him. Daniel's God, our God, will later on humble Nebuchadnezzar and bring him to his senses. I don't know whether you quite realize how significant that is. Imagine a person with the power of Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And I'm going to run out of really powerful people, and I've started too high. All the other powerful people, and you pack them into one, and that is Nebuchadnezzar. And yet this same Nebuchadnezzar is brought to his knees before God to say, he is the only God. And if you don't worship him, I'm going to pull your house down. That wasn't the greatest thing to say, Nebuchadnezzar. But he understood that there was only one God. And I think he was converted. And he's the same God who can then turn the page on pompous, arrogant Belshazzar at his feast in the next chapter. And he's the God who raises up Cyrus and tells him what to do. And in chapter 11, we will get there, God willing. He maps out what he's going to do over the next centuries in such incredible, intricate detail that many, many scholars get to this point and they say there is no way that Daniel, the book, could have been written before 530 BC. It has to be written after 190 BC, because all of these events that he talks about happen. Marriages, alliances, invasions, wars, kingdoms falling apart. And the scholars, they look at it and they say, there's no way that was written in 500 BC. That was written by someone afterwards, looking back. Well, their God is too small. Daniel's God controls history. My God controls history. I'm not apologizing for him knowing the future like he knows the past. He's the God who turns the page of history till he'll turn the final page, and he'll bring about all of the things that he's promised in Daniel and in the rest of his Bible. And of course, they all point to Jesus, which is just what thrills me so much about this book. In this book, we'll meet Jesus in the Old Testament. We'll meet him in a fiery furnace, walking with his people. I don't know who's got that chapter, but I'm so jealous. And we'll meet Jesus in the latter part of the book, and nobody's volunteered for any of those chapters yet, so that's good news. We'll meet him in chapter 7, verse 13. Daniel says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like the Son of Man. And he came to the Ancient of Days, and he was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, that all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall not pass away, and his kingdom, one that shall not be destroyed. Daniel sees Jesus, and he sees Jesus being given the kingdom. One like us has stood in the presence of God, and he's received everything from God. Where the kings of Judah had failed, and the kings of Babylonia and Medo-Persia and Greece and then Rome, they would all come to an end. We, with Daniel, see the coming of a greater king. How ironic it is that all of Nebuchadnezzar's treasures are now in museums in various parts of Western Europe, in London, in parts of Germany. The one who put God into the museum at the beginning of chapter 1 now has his kingdom put into museums. And where's the church today? Well, the church is growing and growing and growing and becoming this kingdom that fills the whole earth. And that's another theme of Daniel. The stone cut out of the rock without human hands that smites the kingdoms of this world grows to fill the earth. But let's think about Daniel's secret for a moment. Daniel's God, awesome. Daniel's secret, he knows that God. Daniel has a relationship, a personal relationship with the Ancient of Days. I find that amazing still. the God of Daniel, who reigns over the whole of history, who picks up and who puts down empires, cares about, knows about, loves tiny specks of humanity like Daniel and me and you. And this is a God that we can know and we must know. He's a God who loves his people. There's another part later on in Daniel where the weight of what he's seen, that the struggles of this world leave Daniel on his hands and knees. He's an old man now, and he's just like bowed down by what he's seen. And Jesus comes to him and touches him on his shoulder and says, "Oh, Daniel, greatly loved, stand up." That's this God that we can know. This one who picks up the trumps and puts the trumps down is the God who in the gospel comes to us and puts his hand on our hearts and says, "It's okay, greatly loved one. I know about you. I care about you. I love you." And that's Daniel's secret. He knows this God. As our other Dan was saying, as he was telling us what the title of this series was, it comes from chapter 11, but the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action. This was Daniel's secret. He knew his God. He listened to him because he loved hearing his voice. He read his Bible. Didn't have as much as we had. He'd love to have had as much as we had. But what he had, he read. Not because he wanted to get through Jeremiah in a week, but because he wanted to hear what God had to say. Because he wanted to know his God better. And he talked to his God. How many times do we find Daniel praying? He loved having fellowship with his God. And he believed that the God who reigns over history listens to and responds to the prayers of his people. But then in closing, we just need to think about Daniel's message. And it's a message that really speaks to everybody. I can't find anyone who Daniel doesn't speak to. He speaks to individuals, first of all. And this is a book which is so encouraging for individual believers as we face a hostile world and the Babylons of our day. God had led Daniel into one of the most difficult times in history. And yet his faith was formed and forged in the fires of those days. He shone for God in all that he did. You see him at every stage of life. You see him as a young person facing challenges that I hope our young people won't face. Having to leave home and family and being led into captivity. But we also see him as a young man going to university for the first time. Doesn't that talk to some of you? And seeing the importance of having a Christian union. Because he sets up the first Christian union in history. And we see him going out into his first job. Facing his first crisis in his first job. Because all the people like him are being executed by a mad king. We see what he does when he faces a crisis. We see him meeting with great success and advancement. We see him meeting hostility and slander. We see him faced with temptation to save himself from the lions by not worshipping the Lord and not praying to him. And I'll hang my head in shame that Satan has never needed the prospect of lions to stop me from praying. And yet, maybe I'll catch Daniel's excitement again as I see his God is my God, and even lions won't stop me praying in the future. I want to know him better. We see a man who's delightfully unencumbered by all that this world has to offer. He actually one day will tell a king to keep all of his treasures, give them to someone else. Belshazzar was desperately trying to give him half the kingdom, and Daniel said, not interested, because he knew something better. He knew his God. He had the greatest treasure of all. He loves his God. We see the same consistency in the middle years and in the later years. He doesn't become a hardened cynic in his old age. He's as excited and in love with the Lord at 90 as he was at 19. It's a book for all Christians who live and work and witness and sometimes suffer and struggle in our Babylons. We need God to raise up a new generation of Daniels and Danielas. There's also a message for the church. Look up, Daniel says, and look forward. They must have felt so defeated and discouraged as they were exiled to Babylon. Yet it was in Babylon that God gave some of the most exalted visions of what his church would be. And I wonder if the exile wasn't just like a little rehearsal for Jesus in the Old Testament to say, this is what I'm going to do in the new. I'm going to build my church and the gates of hell are not going to prevail against her. And I'll show you, I have a little dry run in the exile. 70 years of what we're then going to have 2,000 plus years of. And I'll show I can do it. And he did it. And he's still doing it today. But also there's a message for the world. Daniel's a unique book in the Bible. It's written in two languages. Chapter 1, verse 1 to chapter 2, halfway through verse 4, is written in Hebrew. And then chapter 2, halfway through verse 4 to the end of chapter 7, is written in Aramaic. And then the rest of the book after the end of chapter 7 is written in Hebrew again. Why? Was Daniel showing off? Fluent, could switch out of both languages just like that? I don't think so. Aramaic was the international language of the 5th century BC. It was the English of its day. It's what the academics all spoke. It's what everybody spoke. They all understood Aramaic. And I think what God's doing is he's saying this is a book for the whole world. This is one of the most evangelistic books of the Old Testament. This isn't just for my people, Israel, to encourage them and to assure them that I'm on the throne and they need to hold on. God's talking to the nations too, to the whole world. The world that thinks it can put the Lord in a museum. And in this book, God is spelling out his manifesto. I will reign over history. I will raise up and I will put down kingdoms. And I will send a king who will set up an everlasting kingdom. And that one, like the Son of Man, Jesus Christ, will come and he will show how greatly loved this world is when he, the King of Kings, died in shame and agony in order to save sinners like Daniel and me. And then rose to guarantee that resurrection that the book of Daniel finishes with. And points to. I think God is speaking to the troubled nations that will never find peace. And he's saying, there is peace. And it's found in knowing Jesus Christ, my son, knowing me through him, coming into this relationship so that you can say, I know this God. And I trust him. And it doesn't matter what 2019 is like, because it's probably not going to be quite so bad as 605 BC. God proved himself then, and he'll prove himself today. And you're really left with a challenge, aren't you, in the middle of that Aramaic section. You've got two kings. You've got Nebuchadnezzar, the greatest of the kings, who came to acknowledge that God was king. And to put his trust in God and know God. And then you've got his son or grandson, Belshazzar, who mocks God and rejects God and walks into a terrible eternity that very night. Daniel's an evangelistic book, and he says, where are you? Are you ready to submit to the king that you could never, ever put in a museum? Because he's a living God. Are you ready to give your life to him and know him, or are you going to resist him? Well, please God, that as we go on through this great book, we'll be at that new generation of Daniels who know our God, love him, trust him, and he uses in 2019 to do great things for his name. Amen.